Hello, welcome to the first day of our 2024 Rahatsu Sashin. We're starting on Monday and finishing on Sunday. Many of us are going to be in person, which is so delightful after our years of struggling with COVID and needing to be far apart and completely only through Zoom. But we have people joining us on Zoom as well throughout the Rahatsu, which is also really lovely. Today we have a couple of people, somebody from Maryland, somebody from Virginia. So a little too far to throw a stone and hear each other, but we can do it through Zoom, which is nice. So I'm thinking as I start this that we don't know what each other are thinking, but sometimes we can share what we're thinking a little bit. And one of the things I think about before I sit down to speak to you in the seat, in the Dharma seat, when I'm bowing, it's really one of my favorite parts of this, when I'm actually not speaking, when I'm just bowing, when I do these three bows to the altar. And I often appeal to Suzuki Roshi to help me as I'm getting ready to sit down in this seat. And it's very much from my heart. I was not, he was not alive when I was physically in the Bay Area, I don't think at all. You know, I probably was about 9 when he passed, maybe younger. But obviously, being that I'm a lineage holder in his line, somewhere in that line, there's Cook, and for me it was Suzuki Roshi, and his life and his teachings and the students he left to go on with the teachings. But since then, I've grown to be very appreciative of the ancestors that are in ancient Japan, you know, decades or centuries really ago, who made great efforts to promote Buddha's way, to do it in a way that I find appealing, which is to sit quietly by myself in silence and trust the silence to help me integrate my being, sometimes facing the walls. And so I thought today we would spend a little time, or I would offer, not extensive, but some guidelines for our time together to hopefully make it more supportive of your experience, beneficial of your experience. This lovely. This is a ginkgo leaf. It's one of my very favorite trees. It's kind of here. I bet the shoe soap put it there. Thank you, shoe soap. Is that answer? Or bet you? Great view. So since this has been being recorded, I usually go ahead and say what my name is. My Dharma name is Shinshi Inryu. Shinshi means body wisdom, and Inryu means hidden dragon. And my teacher, the teacher who gave me that name, is Daimyu, Michael Winger. Dai means great. So the great dragon offered me that name when I received Jukai, when I received the six bodhisattva precepts from him in the summer of 2005. And so he became our guiding teacher, our Sangha's guiding teacher. Now we've been 20 years. In 2004, we celebrated in February 20 years practicing the way of Zen in this space. And over the years, we've become sometimes more, well, definitely more formal, taking on more of the guidelines as part of our practice. It seems like we're benefiting that there are people that are attracted to practicing within that way. But there's always something to adjust to or to learn. So I thought I would talk a little bit about that. So these guidelines for practicing together, they're called Shingi. the school that we're in was founded by a man named Dogen, who practiced in Japan and China, came back from China to Japan. And then the other primary great teacher, original early teacher, is Keizan. And he actually practiced with Dogen, but was given transmission from a few steps away from Dogen. So the these ideas about people getting together and having some rules about what they do when they're together, it goes back many centuries. You know, they're trying to figure out how to be not hitting each other's elbows too hard as we're moving through the hallways and as we're serving food to each other and that kind of thing. So Keizan Joken, he lived from 1268 to 1325. He founded a temple in the mountains north of Kyoto called Tsujiji. It's an area that there's a lot of active earthquakes and that sort of thing. The temple became very, very robust and strong, and actually for a while surpassed Dogen's temple, his teacher's temple, in influence and favor. Many thousands of priests were trained there, and then they went back to their communities, right? They went back to Washington, D.C., like Charlottesville, Virginia, and Rockville, Maryland, and they set up little practice places, and they helped people when people were going through transition, with people dying or sick, or if people were apt for it to sit zazen and learn the way that they had been trained. So something about it turned the key for many people, because now in Japan there are between 14,000 and 15,000 Soto Zen temples. So over the centuries, these seeds from the flowering of the teachings went almost everywhere. And then they made their way to our shores. And yeah, and there's this phrase that the Dharma will continue to move from east, from west to east. So from India, China to Japan to the west coast of the United States, and then east coast, and keep going, just globally it's moving. So sometimes it might feel like we're in like some little small pocket that we hardly understand what we're doing. How can we ever explain it to anybody else, right? But it's helpful to me to know there are so many other people that are practicing this way, that are facing the wall, that are seeking the way of Buddha, the way of Bodhidharma. So that's all kind of a preamble to say, you know, what is the Shingi? What is this thing about practicing in harmony? And the other thing I'd like to just bring forward, because I'll read a little bit from Zen Master Keizan, is that Zen Master Keizan, he comes out, it seems like, oh, these two guys, what do they know about, you know, being in the world and practicing when you don't have certain equipment or you have other equipment? But Keizan, he was really, really close to his grandmother and his mother. His grandmother was a big supporter of Dogen. His mother went on to be an abbess at a Soto temple. And so, you know, his heart very much is impacted by the influence of not just male teachers in his life, but these profound male teachers. And as we look in this room, we are about equally men and women, which is really beautiful. Feels more balanced somehow. So also Keizan is on my mind because we had a chance to go to his temple, a few of us, the Benji and Chuso and I, we went to his temple in April in Japan. We made just a kind of pilgrimage. It was pretty amazing for me, and I think for a lot of people. And we spent a night there, and we ate, you know, these amazing 20 compartment bento box meals, and we, you know, yeah, just tried to stay upright in the glassy wooden floors as we, you know, went through the hallways and in our tabi socks. So it was something to be in that space. And to be in that space and know that there are monks practicing, usually they go for a couple of years, usually not longer than a couple of years to practice there. Then they go back and back to their family temples, or they might found a practice place. But something I learned while we were there is that their training doesn't end there. Their training is to come back and do ceremony at those temples and bring their family members and bring their community members there. So that when there's a regular Jukai, it's all these people who are coming back to Aheiji, they're coming back to Sojiji, they're coming back to that training, they're re-engaging with the walls and the floors that they had come intimate with as young monks, right? So that also felt good to me. It kind of feels like us as lay people, that being able to practice, going back into our lives, and then coming back into a practice setting and doing our chanting and learning some new things, even though we might be considered experts out in the lay world in certain ways. There's always more we can learn about ourselves and this way of being in Zen practice and constant discovery about the self. I thought this was a fun statement, just actually from 1960s, from the abbot who had been at Sojiji. His name was Kedo Chisan Koho Zenji. And here he's kind of talking about the relevance of our Zen practice to, like, why do it, you know, if we live in the world. He says, "In religions, on the one hand, we must go forward ever deepening our religious experiences, while on the other hand, recognizing our mission to guide other people to the depths of our own experience. We must enable them to know the joy that comes from the knowledge of the Dharma and the bliss that comes from the practice of meditation. It is absolutely essential to have a personal character like that of Great Master Keizan in order to carry out this mission, to regard all people with warm affection, to become the friend of the common people, to enter the realm of the ideal together, and with them to share one's joys with others. These are the characteristics of the true person of religion." So Soto School believes that it is able to fulfill its basic mission because of the stern, father-like character of Dogen and the compassionate, mother-like character of Keizan. So they cut it kind of sweet too, to put it in that frame. But he's basically saying it's the real purpose is to meet the world, right, with kindness and care. And sometimes it takes some sternness, and sometimes it takes a great deal of softness. And that's where Manjushri comes in, right, asking us to be wise and figure out what side of the sword is appropriate in the moment. So what is a shingi? What are the rules? Again, they refer to the guidelines, regulations for monastic life within our Zen tradition. So Dogen wrote a whole document about this called the Ehei Shingi, and it details very minutely the practices and expectations for monks, covering all aspects of their daily routines, meditation posture, proper conduct, interactions with the community, all aimed at cultivating mindfulness and ethical living within the monastery, all the way down to, like, how to brush your teeth. Pretty detailed. Or when to brush your teeth and how to do it, right? So, you know, Duncan's a few centuries back in Japan, trying to kind of get some way of kind of holding together this community of men and women practitioners together early in his teaching practice, but still be informed on how to interact as you step out of the monastery gate. And some people get real rigid about that. We have been studying the Sandokai, this ango, this practice period. And Sekito, he's asking us to take a bigger picture, to see a bigger aspect, to not get too locked in to being rigid and strict, right? To see the value of many different ways of doing things, to see how they're all perfectly touching. And part of the translation, you know, for the Sandokai is sometimes the looking at the difference in harmony. So in our families, in our relationships, and in our sanghas, how do we live in harmony? And it may be that though we're very individual in our view, or particular in our view, that for a period of time at least, the greater goal might be to find that harmony, might be to look for that harmony as a way of expressing and feeling our own, the conditions we're creating for our own awakening, our own enlightenment. It might be really worth looking closely at how can we create that harmony, which sometimes means doing things we might, you know, prefer to be doing something else at that moment in time. But we put ourselves in a situation. Those of you who have come to listen to this talk, to sit quietly and listen to me, like, you know, you might be a little uncomfortable where you're sitting or thinking, yeah, I know about the Shingi, or you know, I think I could benefit from sleeping or calling somebody, but you stepped into this circle and you just kind of said, okay, I'm going to be here, right? So you're already taking that step, you're sort of stepping back and saying, oh, let me experience something I don't have, that I don't know what's going to happen. So kind of getting away from maybe our habitual thinking, or thinking in a rote way, you know, our pattern of thinking is going like this, and then the circumstance pulls us out of that groove a little bit. So we're less kind of locked into always thinking the same way. So how does that happen? Well, first off, when does it happen? You might think to yourself, well, I never have habitual thinking. That doesn't happen to me. So some simple examples I came up with when I was thinking about this talk was eating without tasting the food. Do you ever do that? Driving a car without collecting all aspects of oneself before putting the transmission into drive. Do you ever do that? Showering without feeling the water. Have you ever done that? I've done that. How can I do that? How can that be? We are often so divided. The mind somewhere, occupied with something or someone far away, and the poor heart and body hoping not to get damaged in the absence of the presence of love. So we have this prescription, like a medicine, to get reintegrated. These actions and non-actions to point the way toward living and awakening to our lives and what is. I remember going to City Center, San Francisco Zen Center, early in my practice. I would often stay there for a few nights when I would be en route to see my mother, particularly who was living up in the mountains near Yosemite. And I was pretty wide-eyed because I was like, what is this? What is this place? And I happened to go into one of the guest rooms and somebody had left behind from the prior ongo, the prior practice period, the shingi that Darlene Cullen and W. Michael Wenger had somebody put together to give out to all the people attending the ongo, or at least the sashin. And I remember the subject of the ongo was the one who is not busy. That was the title of the ongo. That's what they were studying. We were studying the Sandokai, that's what they were studying, the one who's not busy, that koan. Right? And so this sheet was about a page and a half. They might have been numbered items, so maybe there were 30 or 40 items that they were telling people the do's and the don'ts. I thought, that's interesting. And then I went to Tassajara in 2016 for a practice period, and the list was 3 pages long. And so the list I remember from when I was at City Center were things like refrain from making eye contact with other people in the practice period. Refrain from touching, physically touching other people. Refrain from touching other people's oryoki bowls. So there were all these kind of things that we might naturally like greet somebody and look up and smile at them, or encounter somebody we hadn't seen for a little while and wish to come forward and embrace them. Or maybe somebody forgot to put their oryoki bowls by their spot for lunch. Oh, I'll help them. So these things that we might normally do, the shingi's asking us to stop and think about, is that how you're supposed to conduct yourself right now? If a lot of people are eating together, we don't want to be touching each other's bowls and napkins and things. And likewise, if somebody is going really deep in their practice, it may be intrusive for you to step in and try to make eye contact. Right? Or it might be a person might have some reaction that what you didn't intend it when you touch them, because they're going deep into their practice. Sometimes wrestling their demons, sometimes just wrestling their mind to be at peace with their body and heart. So we don't know. But these shingi, these rules, they're meant to support each of us, allow us to be in harmony in this protective container for us to feel safe, for us to feel like we're willing to risk it a little bit, to be vulnerable, to be with each other without the masks, you know, without the credentials and the business cards and the titles. And So when I went to Tassajara 2016, the shingi that was like 3 pages long, maybe more than that. And one of the things that really stood out to me on the list was that they didn't want anybody sleeping in any public areas where other people might see them sleeping. So the only place you're supposed to sleep was in your home room. You couldn't lay weren't supposed to lay down. And then to make it even harder, I don't know if any of you've been to Tassa Heart, they have all these beautiful like outdoor lounge furniture, chairs and various things. So it's really inviting if you have a book to sit down or take your meal, you're outside and eat on. They take all that and they put it in like a barn or something. So there you are for 3 months and there's nowhere easy even to be outside and sit down. You have to go, if you want to go sit down, you've got to go find a smooth rock, right? Or go sit on the ground. Talk about a way to get in touch with the nature that you're living immediately in, right? If you don't have that inviting chair between you and relaxing outside, you know? And so I don't think it's not necessarily, it's not meant to, it's probably meant to preserve the chairs for guest season. But one of the consequences of it is that it rubs us a little bit, right? Something isn't as easy or casual or non-thinking because they've taken the chairs away. You have to really think about, where do I want to sit my soft behind to sit down outside? Or if I'm not supposed to be singing or making music, reciting poetry that other people can hear, well, how can I go outside and do that and not bother other people? I might have to really seek out a good spot, a very private spot. And you know, when you find those private spots, often it's really magic. You know, when you seek out those spaces. But sometimes we're kind of forced to. They took the chairs away. So you had to kind of figure something out for yourself. And when you're a little uncomfortable, you're more often to be in the moment too. And it's not that I want to convince you to move into discomfort. But one of my teachings in my yoga teaching practice is to ask students to go to the edge of what's comfortable, which is also the edge of what's not comfortable. They share that same place. And then, often, if we touch it and it's a little too sharp, that sword tip is a little too something, step back, take a breath, decide if you want to reapproach it again. And if you can get to the edge of what's comfortable, which is the edge of what's not comfortable, and take a few breaths, the edge moves. The edge shifts location. And that can be where we start to gain more freedom. To not be confined by that sharp, enclosing rigidity, but to test it. So I've mentioned typical things are silence, not talking to each other, not touching, not seeking eye contact, taking adequate nourishment, right? The sangha is trying to provide something healthy and the right amount of calories for you. So please don't deny yourself what you need to be in as good a health as possible. And maybe food that you're not accustomed to. Many of us have certain things, we have a rotation of certain things we eat over and over again. And so often we come to sashin, things come in front of us, we have never seen that color of food before, or we have never had that type of fruit before, or something like that. So usually the prescription is just to try, at least try a taste of it, to go to the edge of what's comfortable and see. Maybe that, you know, the world opens with a piece of kiwi. I don't know. And then in working as well, we have a short work period each afternoon before tea. And so to maybe even see if our relationship with an activity can be in full engagement just for the time that you've been given to do it, and then to leave it alone. So without needing to finish it, can we work with that? Can we work with just doing it as well as we can within the time we have? That sounds like a big life lesson. To do things as well as we can with the time we have. To do the activity maybe without bringing forward additional aversion or attraction to the activity. To evaluate all activity equally, all work equally. That's a great lesson for us to really learn together as Sangha and take out into the world. Because the world does not get that. So to really engage with that. Am I done? How many minutes? I think I'm pretty close to done.
11:05.
It's supposed to be done at 11?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm learning this.
The schedule is deep in the Benjamin pocket. You're pulling it out like a rabbit out of the magician's hat.
Yeah, this Dharma talk ends at 11.
It's over. No, I do want to leave you with just a little bit of words of Kazan himself. He's really dear to me. I love Dogen, but I think I love Kazan more. But he said, oh, I'm sorry, and this is from two of his prominent writings. This is a Zazen Yo Jinki, the points to watch in Zazen. The Buddha is supposed to have said that hearing and thinking about Buddhism is like standing outside the gate, but that Zazen is truly returning home and sitting down in comfort. This is true. In hearing and thinking of Buddhism, opinions prevail. The mind remains confused. It is truly like standing outside the gate. But in this Zazen, all things disappear. It is not conditioned by place. It is like returning home and sitting down in comfort. So as we move through the week together, maybe that can be our refrain. In this Zazen, can we together in harmony return home to ourselves, return home to Sangha, to Dharma, to Buddha, and to be comfortable in that, even when we're uncomfortable. Right? Touching the edge of what's not comfortable, touching the edge of what is comfortable, so we can be at peace in those moments all the time. And keep growing, keep opening, keep creating the conditions for that opening. May we together this week explore what harmony is, get to know each other through our peripheral vision, be kind in many ways as we traverse this unknown and known path. And we keep pulling our mind back to practice. And we seek to have a mind and heart and body and breath right here, right now. Drinking in our life. strengthening our heart, clearing the mind, so that we can just be with each other, be with Buddha. Of us,
ten directions, three times, all higher ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom.
Welcome to join me for these closing bows.